Oh, welcome everybody. This is the seventh lecture. The seventh lecture in my course on the Arahant and the Four Truths in Early Buddhist Discourse. It's a small announcement I need to make. Next week there will be no lecture. I am going to be in the US for a week. I'm leaving tomorrow early morning. So the next lecture will only be on the 28th of June. I'm sorry for this little gap in the series. I had originally been planning to do the lecture there from the States, but the conditions there are not right. They don't have wireless. They only have wireless, and with that, this Connect software doesn't work. And so I feel it's better to have a gap than to try to give a lecture and maybe it won't work. But I hope you will forgive me and you will remember in 2 weeks not to leave me all alone here in front of the computer and join me on the 28th of June. There were again a number of interesting contributions on the blog that I'm going to take up now. First thing, this is still related to the to lecture 5, the discourse on Dhananjani and his receiving the Brahmavihara instructions and then getting reborn in the Brahma world. And there was also reference to the hells. And Sylvester Schröger, he made this comment. He says, the early discourses and the texts of the later traditions even more are full with violent speech, with diverse analogies, like the story of the two strong men and the torture, a small man by burning him on red-hot coals, etc. Can we really attach this violent speech to the Buddha? And then he also says, but seriously, hell is an archaic religious concept. In the diverse text examples, there is not any metaphoric but a lot of pathological mind. Do we really need it any longer? What do you mean? Shall we forget the age of science enlightenment? Can we really attach this concept to the Buddha? Yeah, I was very happy that he expressed his thoughts because I have myself, I'm sometimes a little puzzled with these descriptions. There was one thing that we discussed last year briefly. I'm not sure in the lecture on the blog. There's this very stark simile for the nutriment of edible food, which describes a couple who travel with their child through the desert and they are stricken by hunger and thirst, and in the end they decide to kill the child and eat it so they survive. And this is one of these images I find so absolutely gruesome, and I'm totally unable to relate to that. And I also admit that when I was studying the Majjhima Nikaya, there's this discourse which describes the different hell realms, and exactly like there's this hell realm, and there you get molten iron poured down your throat, and there's this, and you get thrown in this acid river and pulled out again, and you have to climb up these trees with thorns that spikes, and all this kind of descriptions, and it had a number of Chinese parallels, and it was really challenging my patience to have to go through this material and compare it and see if there's any differences or not. Yeah, so I fully sympathize with Sylvester that somehow we find it difficult to relate to these descriptions. However, this is one point. I think another point is the question of, is this actually what was said by the Buddha or not said by him? And there's a little problem here. I mean, okay, we do not know for sure what the Buddha said. We can't say this about anything with absolute certainty. But what we have to have an approximation of what the Buddha taught is these Pali Nikayas and their Agama parallels. And they all have this kind of stuff. So inasmuch as we are able to base ourselves on evidence, we can only say, look, this stuff is there. And I think it's important also, and this is something I certainly don't mean Sylvester, I'm just taking up this topic because it is something that is running on in my mind also. There's a danger in this comparative study kind of thing, that because these canonical texts lose their authority, as we are kind of, like my work actually, in a way undermines that authority, saying, look, it's not, this is just as the Bible said, finish, this is just what the Buddha said, finish, but actually this is what the Buddha says according to this text, but then this text puts it a little different, so which one is right? This kind of attitude then can go overboard and make us into interpreting only what we can relate to and what we understand as the original word of the Buddha. And anything that doesn't suit our ideas or conceptions, oh, that must be late, that's no, that can't be, you know. Hey, come on. The Buddha, he wouldn't say something like that, would he? No. And this is a little dangerous, I think. There's, for example, two things which I am not in agreement with, just giving two examples. One example I read some time ago, somebody was questioning the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing on the mere ground that there are 16. You see, it's just too complicated. That can't be from the Buddha. But we have this 16-step scheme in the Theravada, we have a Mula Savastivada version, we have a Mahasangika version. This is about as broad a spectrum we can get from the different traditions. And I don't know if it is really necessary to think that the Buddha was only able to speak a handful of poems and nothing else. No, I mean, that sometimes seems to be the idea. Or another regular criticism of the Four Noble Truths, to come a little bit closer to the topic that we will be discussing later. In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first, according to tradition, the first discourse by the Buddha and various parallels, we get these 12 turnings. So each of the four truths in three ways. And because this is a little bit of a complex idea, immediately we get all this, oh, no, this can't be original. Hey, this is Abhidharma, no? But I'm not so sure about if it works so easily. You see, I'm at present doing a comparative study, and all the versions that I'm able to find have this stuff. And in an oral setting where you can't take notes, you can't look it up later, it is actually necessary for you to formulate thought in a somewhat complex manner. It is quite meaningful to say, look, there is four truths, and in three ways they become 12. This is something that sticks in the mind. So I don't think, again, that it is we can easily dismiss the evidence of the text. The texts do not give us the chance to come back all the way to the historical Buddha himself. We are at a distance of, let us say, 2 centuries or so. Still, that's much closer than we are today. So, coming back to the very welcome comment by Sylvester, what I feel is that there's two questions here. One is, did the Buddha teach hell, and did he use these gruesome similes? As far as we're able to say from the text, yes. Second question, what are we going to do with it? And yeah, that's a completely different question. We accept, okay, as far as the text tells us, there is hell. There is this gruesome images of this poor fella being roasted on coal and all that. What do we do with it? And that's a different question then. And I think there's a lot of room. Like I just said, look, for me, hell doesn't mean anything. And there was a beautiful comment on the blog by Salvador Arvadas, who said that even heaven doesn't really mean anything for him. I thought that was really nice. But that's a different question. We should not, this is the point I want to make, we should distinguish between our attempt to try to understand the source material and then the way we deal with it. And yes, there is also a tradition, and then Rodolfo Rivas Molina had already pointed that out. Sometimes when we compare, we find that some of the very strong statements are only there in one tradition, not in the other. So there is some room for thinking, and I think this is particularly the case with negative statements about women. Misogyny? Well, my own research has given me the impression that there is a tendency for this to become stronger in the course of time. And there's another point made by Giuliana Martini. She says that we should also keep in mind that the Buddhist hell is presented as a temporary condition and something that is the result of our intentional actions. I think that's also helpful. This is helping us to make sense of it. Yeah, this is what I wanted to say on hell. So if there's any comments, I'll feel better. And after the comments, we get out of hell. Mark, these description of torture were common punishments used by kings in the time of the Buddha. Yes, as far as we are able to tell, they were. And it seems they were somewhat more cruel than people are today. And we get similar images and descriptions in Jain text. I have done quite some reading of Jain text because I was interested in the parallelism. In fact, the simile that I have most difficulty with, the parents eating their own child, it's somewhere in the Jaina scriptures also. So this seems to be an image drawn from the contemporary society. Hugo Di Dio, there are all sorts of people in the world, and probably the Buddha includes all of them. Imagine teaching Dhamma to former soldiers of Ugandan war. Maybe they should feel they can relate more to these type of stories and become arahants like Akunimala. Yes, Hugo. Yeah, keeping in mind the different audience, that the ancient Indian audience would have been different from what we are used to today. That's also a very good point. Let me see. Andrew? No? Mark? So this seems to indicate the source is not in the other realms, but from this earthly life. I'm not sure I understood, Mark. Yeah, I need help. I didn't understand. Can't help this silly monk, no? Mark, if the punishments were seen by people in the time of the Buddha, it was not through supervision of other realms that they were seen. The punishments, there were certain very cruel punishments for criminals at those times. And this is, we get these descriptions like, for example, Majjhima Nikaya 13, I think, Mahaduka Kanda Sutta. And so these would be projected onto the hell realms. And the hell realm descriptions we get in Buddhist texts are similar to what we get in Brahminical texts and in Jain texts. So I don't think we need to take the description of the hell realm as the Buddha's omniscient vision declaring how things really are. I hope I got you right this time. Andrew, I think the Buddha probably used different similes for different groups of people according to their conditions, etc., just like the fire-burning simile. I had difficulty digesting simile of killing or military, but those simile may work for others. Yeah. Thank you, Andrew. I also don't like the military similes. I had a lot of problem with the butcher simile in the Satipatthana Sutta. There's a simile describing the contemplation of the four elements with cutting up a cow, and I am a dedicated vegetarian for so many years, and I thought like, hey, mindfulness, can't we have this? Do we have this stuff in there? No. But what to do? I can't change it. Yeah. So now we come again to the practice of metta and the Brahma Viharas. We are still with lecture 5. This is by Wei Yin Cho. She made a very beautiful point. She said, one can't give what one can't receive, and one can't receive what one can't give. This basic issue of metta and accepting oneself. Yeah, and I just wanted to say that I believe that this boundless way of practicing metta is a solution to some degree, because it's effortless. So it gives a lot of room, and it allows then a step-by-step acknowledging of whatever negativity towards oneself may be still in our heart. This is the most important point, this kind of realizing that there's some negativity is there. Laura De Bernardi made that point also on the blog. And it's very important to deal with that now, because it's anyway there in the mind, and the time of death will come for sure. And at that time, this kind of stuff will come up to the surface. And at the time of death, it's quite probable that there will be some physical problem. It's quite probable there will be some mental preoccupation with going towards something that one does not know, having to let go of a lot of things that one does not want to let go of. So it's really very useful to deal with the dark spots in the mind now, at a time when one is healthy and has the chance to do it gradually and doesn't have to take the whole stuff in one go. It's very important, I think, and this is one of the purposes of Buddhist meditation. So, the boundless radiation of metta and the other Brahma Viharas is, as far as I can tell, an excellent way of, first of all, becoming aware that there is some negativity, because the metta doesn't really work, or it gets, one feels tired of it, or something is there. And at that point, one simply stays with that openness of the mind in this boundless radiation, which doesn't mean you have to force out the metta in all directions with a lot of strength, but just being open in all directions, that's all. Just like you open all the windows in the house, you don't start to let the wind blow, no need. You just open the windows and the wind will go and give fresh air in the house. So you just open up in all directions and be with that acknowledgement of that negativity, lack of appreciation of oneself, whatever it is, and allow the natural sunshine of metta to dissolve that step by step, very slowly, very gradually. And it's a little bit like the image I like is like a bud that is touched by a flower, that is going to be a flower. You can't force it open, no? That will just destroy it. You need the sun to touch that bud, and slowly, slowly it will open. And sometimes that bud may be in ice water. It's frozen. So you need a lot of time for the sun to solve that ice. Give it that time. Just let it be, and slowly, slowly it will open. And there was another comment by Wei Yin Cho also about metta should be combined with the Brahma Viharas, and I just wanted to say that I believe, as far as I can tell from practice and from the suttas, that it is fine for some time to concentrate on metta only if one wishes so. And that in the long run it should be combined with the other Brahma Viharas. Whereas with compassion and sympathetic joy, I think it is important to, from the outset, to practice them in that context. But this is just my personal impression. Then there's another comment by Wei Yin Cho. She says, does oneself need to have a strong sense of self to feel metta? And it's just this whole topic of not self and the Brahma Viharas, and there's sometimes this idea that in later terminology, emptiness and compassion are kind of incompatible, because emptiness means there's nothing. And how can you have compassion for nothing? Not self doesn't mean that there's nothing. Not self only means there is no unchanging self. But there is a self. a self in the sense of the conditioned, impermanent, changing five aggregates. They are there. It's not that nobody is talking to you. It's not that if I'm talking rubbish now, and you come after and complain, look, Analia said this and this, and I say, hey, no, you can't blame me. No self, nobody there. How? I didn't say this. No, rubbish. What I'm saying now, I'm responsible for. Even if in 5 minutes this Analia has changed, he is still conditionally related to the Analia who is talking now. And if Analia now is talking rubbish, I'm responsible for that. And it is possible for me to give metta, or for me to receive metta, because I'm there, I'm not nothing. So that I think that needs to be clearly understood, and the Brahmaviharas, anyway, in the way I suggest, are not, they are relating to other beings, but not in this kind of identifying manner. This is my friend, I give metta to him, this is the neutral person, but you just radiate it out in all directions. But they are meant to reach out to other beings. And these other beings exist. They do not have a permanent self, but they exist. So, does oneself need to have a strong sense of self to feel metta? One has to have some degree of integrated sense of self. Not the big self that we are trying to get rid of with anatta, but that small self of being able to be at peace with myself. And that is precisely what this boundless radiation can do. Gradually, as I described before. Then there was a comment by Laura De Bernardi. She says, I have a lot of problems with the artificial generation of metta, as so much can go beneath the radar, as it were. At the very moment that one feels wonderful generating metta, hatred can be present but denied. I think that any practice of the Brahmaviharas that is not informed by attentiveness to what is actually arising is potentially highly problematic. Yeah, I thought it was very good that she brought up that point. And that is, again, I'm just talking about my own experience. This is the problem I had when I was doing the commentary away, because it allowed me a certain focus. And I was trying to focus, but I did not really need to genuinely open my heart. And so I was kind of saying to myself the formulas of metta meditation, but it was not really touching my heart. And underneath, all kind of things could have happened. But I feel with this radiation kind of thing, this openness, one will very soon come to know if there's anything underneath. And gradually, step by step, the practice will become less and less artificial, more and more genuine, because all is so open. And you're not forcing or interfering. You just try to have this basic attitude and you open up. And then things come up. Then hatred comes up, or self-hatred, etc. And it's there, it's in the space, and you realize it. You see it's there. And you have an attitude of metta towards it. Very nice. Yeah, there's another thing on metta by Hedwig Krenn. She says, in metta meditation there is most of the time, if not all the time, a lot of joy in me. And I cannot really say if this is part of the metta or mudita or just piti. This is on this whole topic of relationship between mudita, sympathetic joy, the third of the Brahmaviharas, and piti, the joy that one experiences, the wholesome joy one experiences in meditation. Some more comments before I say something. This is from Hugo Didio. He shares his own practice. He says, it was only until piti sukha, this joy or happiness, appeared in my practice that I found myself at times spontaneously radiating metta to friends and foes, and it seemed a natural thing to do. Very beautiful. Nowadays, the experience is that only when the sitting goes deep enough and that joy calm shows up, my daily behavior will notoriously be affected. Traces of karuna and mudita at times will also be present during the daily activities, but as a result of one of those deep meditations. Yeah, I thought it was very beautiful to show us from the practical perspective how that joy can express itself in the Brahma Viharas. Very beautiful. And then there's a comment by Santikaru. He says, when mind is well established in mudita, in sympathetic joy, there will be wholesome piti and sukha, that is joy and happiness, as there can be with breathing and other meditative experiences. The relevant difference, I think, is not whether there is piti and sukha or not, but the basis of piti and sukha, that is mudita or some other samadhi experience, that samadhi is concentration. If this perspective is adequately accurate, comparing mudita and piti sukha is a bit like comparing apples and oranges. Nice simile. Yeah, so I have had time again to think about a nice simile for you. And yeah, my sun simile, Sauda Ardava said that this sun simile I gave last time for the Brahmavyas didn't work for him because he is not so keen on sunlight and warmth, and he finds that rather unpleasant to think of the sun. So I'm sorry, I can't do much. This is always the problem with similes; they are limited. But I have another simile, or maybe I first give. There's a simile also that Santikaru gave, an alternative simile that might work better for those who, like Sauda Ardavas, don't like this sun imagery so much, and he says the simile of a rain cloud. He says it showers upon everyone without discrimination, and it can give a gentle shower or a downpour or even a thunderstorm as need may be, and rain cools and quenches thirst, moistens parched land and gives life. This captures, I think, an important element of compassion. It rejuvenates when there is the dryness of dukkha. Yeah, I just paste this in for you. That is, Santikaru is there offering us, he read it somewhere, he says, another simile for compassion for those of you who find my sun imagery doesn't work so well. But now, regarding sympathetic joy and joy in meditation, I have another of my ideas, and I want to start with a simile that we are getting in the suttas. I have it here on the blackboard. This is the simile for the experience of the second absorption. And the second absorption is, in a way, the peak of piti, of joy experiences. And so this experience is described in the following way. Just as a blue, red, or white lotus being born in the water and having come to full growth in the water remains submerged in water with every part of its roots, stem, flower, and leaves completely drenched and pervaded by water, with no part that is not pervaded by it. And then it continues in the same way, the meditator pervades his or her entire body with this piti sukha, this joy and happiness of the second absorption. So the image that I have is like if we now see the joy, piti, as a lotus flower that is underwater, then the mudita, the sympathetic joy, I would say is like one of these tropical trees totally covered with flowers. The whole tree is full of flowers. And you can, even from a distance, you can smell that almost intoxicating sweet scent of those flowers. And even the whole ground around the tree is covered by flowers. Some of the flowers have already fallen down. In fact, the whole ground is covered with flowers, but still you look up the tree and you wonder, where do they come from? It still seems so full with flowers. If you have been to the tropics, you know what I'm talking about. So the sympathetic joy would be like these flowers. If we compare one by one, the lotus is much bigger, and is because also of its symmetry, it's in a way more beautiful than a single flower from the tree. And that takes care of that aspect of the PET sometimes being more intensive, something that Juliana and Rosa said last time. But the lotus is in the water. We can't see it so well. Actually, we would have to put our head underwater to see it, and we can't smell it. But the flowers on that tree, they can be seen from far away. They can be smelled, and they're all over. They are not, and you can take them as many as you want, and there are still enough. This has this aspect of accessibility, of radiation that Mark brought up. Yeah, so that is my simile for comparing the mudita, sympathetic joy, and the joy of concentration. And obviously, if one does the sympathetic joy to the level of, say, the second jhana, then this is like the flower tree is standing on the board on the edge of a pond, and in the pond you also get the lotus. That's all I have on metta and assorted topics. If there are no comments or questions, I would go on to Lecture 6 to review two things from Lecture 6. Hook Didio, I understand that Juliana mentioned that piti sukha can also be unwholesome. Could you comment on that? Well, joy in principle can also, it need not necessarily be of the wholesome type. The joy we are discussing here, what is the wholesome type? We were originally discussing a joy that arises in relation to tranquility meditation or insight meditation. And I think Juliana on the blog just wanted to broaden the context by saying that in principle, joy, I mean, I can also be happy if I don't like somebody and I hear he has problems, then I can also be happy about that. That will not be very wholesome. Just nothing else comes to my mind. Or the joy a thief has when his robbery is successful. I mean, there are forms of piti and sukha that can be unwholesome. And I think she just wanted to make the contrast that the mudita, as part of the Brahma Viharas, will always be in some way a wholesome state of mind. But I mean, Juliana is here, she can maybe reply herself. Andrew, could you explain a bit further what it means that metta needs the other three to work properly? Well, the point, Andrew, as far as I can see, is like this. If you read through the suttas, you find that metta is very often mentioned on its own and as part of the Brahma Vihara meditation. If you check for the other three, and I mean now upekkha only as a Brahma Vihara, not other types of upekkha, you find them very rarely mentioned. And they usually occur only within this Brahma Vihara meditation context. So my own take on this is that to practice metta on its own is perfectly fine. I don't see any problem. But it is more enriching in my own experience that if at some point when the metta is well established, one broadens it out to encompass the other Brahma Viharas. With the other Brahma Viharas, however, I see a problem if they are practiced independent of their Brahma Vihara context. The problem with compassion is that if it is not balanced by metta on the one side and sympathetic joy on the other side, there is a tendency of having this I am the savior and the others are suffering, of having this, and that can involve some sort of a hierarchy, and that can lead to some degree of conceit or ego. And the problem of sympathetic joy practiced only on its own can lead to some sort of happy-go-lucky, come on, there's no problem, everything is fine, kind of thing. And upekkha, the equanimity on its own, it might lack that opening of the heart that comes through the earlier three. Yeah. What you're saying, the metta is the metta is friendship, mitra. It does not in itself involve a hierarchy. The karuna, because I am looking at those who are usually in a worse position than myself, can involve a looking down. Like Mark was saying, Avalokiteshvara, the one who looks down, kind of. And the sympathetic joy is particularly powerful when it is done towards those where I feel envy or jealousy, and these are usually those who are in some way better off than myself. So without wanting to fix these two into only down, only up, they have these tendencies. This kind of the way how they express themselves in relationship to others. And within the whole context, it balances out perfectly. There's the metta, which is open in any direction. There's a stronger emphasis towards who are below me, lesser well off. There's a stronger emphasis towards those who are better off than me. And then there is the final stepping back, staying with an open heart. So if you do all four together, it's a very meaningful dynamics, and it really balances off nicely, explores different aspects, and sets you up well for dealing with people when you come out of the meditation. But the metta as itself, as it does not have either this up or down kind of thing, it's fine to work just with metta alone. The first thing is to work with metta and get that really established and work through all these resistances that might be within, that what Wayne was saying, and also to get out of the artificial that can be there, or the tiring aspects that can be there. And when it becomes like this and really strong, then it's nice to balance it off by bringing in the other three. It will naturally come. There's a feeling of resistance, so you just keep smiling, sunshine, etc. And after some time, you feel the resistance is gone and the black spots are gone, and it feels fine. And when you get established in that, after some time you get this like, what's next now? And that's precisely the time when it's nice to open it up to the other Brahma Viharas. Mark, it seems that Brahma Vihara meditation easily bridges the gap between sitting meditation and meditation of everyday life, being back in the busy world. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the fantastic things. That it really, and you feel the outcome. Hukte Dio was describing so beautifully. He gets the joy in the practice, and then this, it expresses itself by having more metta and karuna in everyday life. Yeah, it's a really nice way of bridging, and it really pays off immediately. Sometimes especially in the samatha area, you may advance but then find it more difficult to relate to the outside world, because you feel like, just hey, I just want to be on the cushion, leave me alone. Whereas with this one, there's immediately that aspect. And even I find, my personal experience in actual practice, it's easier to relate to outside world, because before I was using another practice that more to develop my concentration, and so whenever there's outside noise, I would get distracted, and that was a disturbance of my meditation. You see, already the terminology tells you a lot, no? Disturbing my meditation. But with the metta thing, I learned that if there's a sound, like last week they were doing some construction work here, and they were making a lot of noise, and I can simply have metta for the sound. It might not be that deeply concentrated metta that radiates into all universes, la-la, but it's still metta. Nobody can distract it. Nobody can disturb it. Fantastic, no? Nobody can disturb that practice unless you do it yourself. Very powerful. Yeah, I'm not sure if somebody else is saying something, but I go on to the next, and you just type, and I'll realize if there's something else. There's a question by Minghao. He says, if anatta is already stream interest described in Madhyamagama 28, we are now a topic of lecture 6, the discourse to the Sikh anatta pindika. How could he be unfamiliar with the Dhamma talks Sariputta gave in Majjhima Nikaya 143? Yeah, you see, I actually had been thinking of talking about this last lecture, but then I saw the time and I skipped out on this part, and so Mingho is telling me I should not skip the things I prepared. Yeah, I wanted to say a little bit more on anatta pindika last time at the end of that discourse. You remember that discourse, anatta pindika is sick and Sariputta visits him. And at the end I said the Madhyama Agama version goes on for a long, long time by giving various stories in relation to anatta pindika, which are not found in the Pali version. I said they are probably a later edition. But I just wanted to say something more about this particular passage that Mingho has brought up. And I was also puzzled by that. And there's a similar passage. We'll just soon come to that in the Chinese Agama parallel. And I, for the sake of writing a paper on this topic, I did a research on how anatta pindika appears in other discourses. So here are just the references for you. We have one very rare occasion where he actually asks a question, and he asks about giving. Who are the worthy recipients of gifted, to whom dana should be given? And then there's a number of discourses to him about giving and about earning one's wealth in the proper way. You get all the references here. And then there's two discourses where the Buddha actually seems to be encouraging anatta pindika. He says he should develop the bliss of meditation. And in another one he tells him that awareness of impermanence, even for this short of time, for the flick of a finger, is more fruitful than giving fruit and lodging a whole, building a whole monastery for the Buddha and his monastic disciples. So the overall impression that we get from this is that anatta pindika was not really interested in insight topics. He had become a stream enterer, so he was endowed with a basic type of insight, obviously. But his whole inclination was towards giving, and this was what he was interested in. And in these two discourses, it seems almost we get the impression as if the Buddha is trying to, hey, come on, don't only give dana, practice, meditate, look at these things. But it seems anatta pindika was simply not receptive to that. And then we get this discourse when anatta pindika is on his deathbed, Majjhima Nikaya 43. And he gets instruction by Sariputta. And at the end of the instruction, he's in tears. And he says, Pali, although I have long waited upon the teacher and bhikkhus worthy of esteem, never before have I heard such a talk on the Dhamma. And here the Samyukta Agama parallel. I have been respectfully supporting the Buddha for over 20 years, yet I never heard Venerable Sariputta give such deep and sublime teachings as I have just heard. So if we take this out of context, as Menghao rightly pointed out, you get this impression that in the early discourses, in the early Buddhism, they didn't really care about lay people. The real stuff on insight was given only to the monastics, and the lay people were left until they almost dead before they get something on insight. But that is actually not really the case if we look at it closer. And I've written a paper on this. I can only share it personally. Those of you who are interested would have to contact me, and I can send it personally. I can't post it because of copyright, where I show that this is not the case, and that even the Majjhima Nikaya and that Samyukta Agama itself, if you look through, you find numbers of teaching, deep, profound teachings on insight up to full awakening given to lay people. So this particular remark by anatta pindika rather seems to reflect the fact that while he was still alive, he was not receptive to insight teachings. And as I said, these two discourses before give the impression the Buddha tried, but then when he, and I presume also the monks, saw, look, this fella doesn't want to hear this stuff, and anyway, he is a stream enter, so he's on the safe ground, so let him do whatever he wants. In the sense that teachings on insight were not forced on people who were not wanting to hear them. But this passage certainly does not mean that the Buddha was keeping a closed fist and that the monks were only passing on the secrets on how to get liberation among each other and leaving the lay people out there at the dead end without getting any instructions. And before I get to the Four Truths, there's one last thing by Hedwig. Hedwig Kren was asking, is the stream mantra in just this moment of stream entry free of the underlying tendencies of lust, hate and delusion when he or she is witnessing Nibbana at this moment? This is a very interesting comment, and I just wanted to briefly comment on that. There are different perspectives in the suttas and in the commentaries. You see, with the commentary tradition, there comes this, it's like a tendency to define what exactly happens at the moment of stream entry or any of the higher stages of awakening. And then this state of mind itself is reckoned as being free from influxes, not underlying tendencies, but influxes, similar term, however. So this state of mind at the actual moment of experiencing Nibbana gets kind of put on a higher level than it is in the suttas. And so from there we sometimes get this feeling that the moment of stream entry somebody is like totally pure. But from early Buddhism this is not the perspective. And the underlying tendencies of lust, there's a very beautiful simile somewhere where there's one monk who thinks that as long as no defilements are in the mind, the underlying tendencies are not there. And the Buddha says, look, it's like a little baby. The little baby can't even think of having lust or is not able to be angry, but the underlying tendencies are there. So from an early Buddhist perspective, the underlying tendencies and also the influxes, they are there even at the moment of stream entry. They are certainly not active. No question, this is the most purest state of mind you'll be able to experience. No defilement there. But the tendency has not been uprooted. The influx has not been eradicated. Therefore, they are still there in some dark recess at the back of the mind. And the person who comes out of stream entry still has some of the influxes, still has some of the underlying tendencies. Yeah, that was the things from the blog that I wanted to take up. Lisa Fancott, I saw you writing in between, but there's nothing on the board. So I think I simply continue. Ah, there it is, Lisa. Sorry for the delay. I just wanted to add that if we are talking about direction, then we could consider upekkha in this way, perhaps up over, iksh to look. Climbing the mountain, looking above or over the whole situation without discrimination in one direction or another. Very nice. Yeah. Yeah, that meets precisely my feeling that with the upekkha I have there's no sense of direction anymore. I was always thinking of it just because I'm kind of stepping back in a way. I'm kind of moving from the foreground of the situation to its background, being open to it but no longer involved. Whereas with the others, in some way or other, I'm more in the foreground, I'm more involved. Upa Iksha. Very nice, thank you. So now we come to the Four Noble Truths. Last time I presented the four basic aspects, this basic scheme, and because next week we don't have a lecture, I have some homework for you, and better you get that scheme in your mind, because the homework is on that scheme. So I repeat it one more time, recognizing the disease, understanding the pathogen, that which has caused the disease, which in the case of the Four Noble Truths is craving. Then seeing the opposite of the disease, the state of health, nirvana in this case. And the cure, the Eightfold Path. And I have argued that this this scheme is taken from ancient Indian medicine. And this idea has been criticized. Several scholars have pointed out that there is no evidence, and particular Professor Wetzler, in the article here I am putting up for you from Indologica Taurinensia, 1984, he makes a very detailed argument saying that there is simply no evidence that in ancient Indian medicine such a scheme was known. However, in a reply to his that is still lingering somewhere for publication, I am arguing the following points. And first of all, I'm saying, as Wetzler himself said, the Ayurvedic texts itself are much later than Buddhist texts. So the evidence is not so strong. We could still expect to find some reference to this diagnostic scheme as a medical scheme in other texts, but Ayurvedic texts, the texts on Indian medicine, we only have much later than the Buddhist text. Then, and this is the discourse I'm going to read now with you, I'm slowly moving out of the Madhyama Agama because I think this is a very important thing. I want to go into it in some detail. The discourse that we are looking at now actually uses that simile of a physician, and it would make no sense for a simile to be spoken to an audience that doesn't know. Like if I give a simile of something to you that you don't know, it's meaningless simile. So by the fact that I am giving the simile of the sun and the full moon, or the lotus and the tree with flowers, anybody from the outside can draw the conclusion, well, at that time they must have had lotuses and trees with flowers, and there must have been a sun and a full moon. I mean, it's a little silly, but just to make that point. So what I think is that this medical diagnostic scheme, it is quite possible that this was just known at the popular level, and that because of that it has not found entry into the Vedic text. And so this is the discourse, my translation. We are in the Samyukta Agama. You get the reference up there. Thus have I heard. At one time the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. At that time the Blessed One told the monks, by accomplishing four principles, one is reckoned a great royal physician, worthy of being the possession of a king and of being a member of the king's retinue. What are the four? One, being skilled in understanding a disease. Two, being skilled in understanding the source of a disease. Three, being skilled in understanding the cure of a disease. Four, being skilled in understanding when a disease has been cured and will not appear again. Before I continue reading, I just want you to note that the sequence of these is not exactly the same as in the Four Noble Truths. Number three and number four are in the opposite sequence. We will come back to that later. How is someone reckoned to be a good doctor who is skilled in understanding a disease? That is, a good doctor is skilled in understanding various types of disease. Then he is reckoned a good doctor who is skilled in understanding a disease. How is someone a good doctor who is skilled in understanding the source of a disease? That is, a good doctor is skilled in understanding that this disease has arisen because of wind, this has arisen due to intestinal disorders, this has arisen due to mucus, this has arisen due to various colds, this has arisen because of a present matter, this has arisen due to seasonal influence. Then he is reckoned a good doctor who is skilled in understanding the source of a disease. How is someone a good doctor who is skilled in understanding the cure of a disease? That is, a good doctor is skilled in understanding that for various types of disease, one should administer medication, or should bring about vomiting, or should administer a laxative, or should undertake nasal instillations, or should administer fumigation, or should bring about perspiration. Then he is reckoned a good doctor who is skilled in understanding the cure of a disease. How is someone a good doctor who is skilled in understanding when a disease has been cured and will never appear again in the future? That is, a good doctor is skilled in understanding how to settle various types of disease so that they are completely eliminated and in the future will never arise again. Then he is reckoned a good doctor who is skilled in understanding how to settle a disease so that it will not appear again. A Tathagata, who is an arahant and a fully awakened one, is also a great royal physician who has accomplished four qualities to cure the disease of living beings, also just like this. What are the four? That is, the Tathagata understands that this is knowing the noble truth of dukkha as it really is. This is knowing the noble truth of the arising of dukkha as it really is. This is knowing the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha as it really is. This is knowing the noble truth of the way to the cessation of dukkha as it really is. Monks, the secular good physician does not understand as it really is the fundamental cure for birth, for old age, for disease, for death, for sadness, for sorrow, for vexation, and he does not understand as it really is the fundamental cure for dukkha. The Tathagata, who is an arahant and a fully awakened one, being a great royal physician, does understand as it really is the fundamental cure for birth, for old age, for disease, for death, for sadness, for sorrow, for vexation, and he does understand as it really is the fundamental cure for dukkha. For this reason, the Tathagata, who is an arahant and a fully awakened one, is reckoned a great royal physician. When the Buddha had spoken this discourse, the monks who had heard what the Buddha said were delighted and received it respectfully. Very powerful discourse, I find. And here, all the parallels. Look, we have two Samyukta Agamas. This is a parallel in the other Samyukta Agama, and with substantial differences. Another Chinese, individual Chinese discourse, then an Uyghur fragment, that is a language in the old Turkish language. And we have a Tibetan version in Shamatha Deva's compendium on the Sutta quotations in the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya, and a discourse quotation in the Abhidharma Kosha Vyakya, and a quotation in the Artha Vinishchaya Sutra. So the mere fact that we do not have a version of this discourse in the Pali Nikayas is not sufficient, I think, for simply dismissing this as late. In fact, in the Pali discourses, the Buddha is regularly referred to as a physician, and a discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya describes how, through the Buddha's teaching, one's sorrow and grief are dispelled. And it uses the same terminology and expressions as used in the First Noble Truth. And this dispelling is then illustrated with the example of being quickly relieved from a disease by a skilled doctor. So clearly this image of the Buddha being like a doctor is at the background of this discourse. It's only that the explicit correlation is not found in the Pali discourses, but it is found in the Vimuttimagga and in the Visuddhimagga. I am not going to read this all for you now. I just leave it there on the board. So, I think that this is one of those cases where I feel that even though the discourse is not found in the Pali Nikayas, you know, this is a problem of oral transmission. Some things might have gone lost. To me, this discourse I just read to you looks very early. It makes a lot of sense. It fits in with the ideas found elsewhere in the discourses. We have at least two distinct transmission lineages of this discourse where there are substantial differences. I have compared them. And the interesting thing to which I drew your attention when we were reading it is that the medical scheme differs from the Four Noble Truths. It has the state of being cured as its third. It's his fourth. And in the Four Noble Truths, it's the third. It's Nirvana comes first, and then that which leads to Nirvana. In the medical scheme, it's the opposite. First there comes the medicine, and last is the doctor knows that the patient is cured and the disease will not come again. This variation, to my mind, only makes sense if I assume that some such diagnostical scheme was already there in ancient India, and on purpose the Buddhist tradition changed that order because it wants to have that consistent pattern of recognizing something and then looking at its conditionality. Recognizing something and then looking at its conditionality. And there's a comment by another professor. This is Willem Alpfas. This is the book. He makes that comment on page 245. He says, if the Four Noble Truths had been borrowed from an earlier medical scheme, the intense sense of discovery of a new and overwhelming insight which the early Buddhists and apparently the Buddha himself attached to the Four Truths would be hard to understand. That is, he is in agreement with Wetzler. He thinks that the Buddha must have discovered this diagnostic scheme. But I disagree. It seems to me that the Four Noble Truth is not the content of what the Buddha realized. What the Buddha realized is nirvana. The Four Noble Truth is the way he explains that. And so, using a simile from a medical context does not take in any way away from the Buddha's awakening. Instead, it makes a rather significant point as far as I can see, because in an ancient Indian setting, which the discourses describe to us as teeming with all kinds of philosophies and theories, the world is like this, there is this, there is not, it would mean that the Buddha on purpose chose medical terminology to express his key insight, his key understanding. It gives a lot of pragmatic flavor to this presentation. And I think this is in a way Buddhism has been said to be the beginning of psychology in the history of mankind. And this gives this statement, which I find very meaningful, gives a lot of force, precisely using this medical terminology. Yeah, that was what I had on the Four Noble Truths as a scheme of diagnosis. If there are no questions on that, then I move on into Madhyamagama 29. We are now going to see this diagnostic scheme used for different aspects, mainly in regarding to dependent arising. You remember the two were discussing Sariputta and Mahakotita. In the parallel versions, the role of who asks the question, who gives the answers, is different. And the question they have is how somebody acquires right view and has unwavering pure confidence in the Dharma, arises at the true Dharma, expressions that clearly indicate, if we search them in other contexts, that clearly indicate that the question is one of attaining stream entry. So the number three reply we get is that somebody knows the influxes or taints, asavas, the arising, their cessation, and the path to that cessation. So here we get a little information then on what these influxes are. There are said to be three influxes: the influx of sensual desires, the influx of the process of existence or coming, becoming, and the influx of ignorance. This is reckoned to be knowledge of the influxes as they really are. These three influxes are very central in the early Buddhist teaching, and the attainment of full liberation, the condition of being an arahant, is usually described as the destruction of these influxes. Or taints. What is knowledge of the arising of the influxes as it really is? In dependence on ignorance, the influxes come to be. And the cessation then, with the cessation of ignorance, the influxes also cease. And the path to the cessation is the Noble Eightfold Path, from right view to right concentration. Venerable Sariputta, if there's a monk who in this manner knows the influxes, as they really are, knows the rising of the influxes, knows the cessation of the influxes, and knows the path leading to the cessation of the influxes as it really is, then he is a monk who has accomplished view, acquired right view, and having untainted, unwavering confidence in the Dharma, has arrived at the true Dharma. Yeah, then the next is, in fact, the Four Noble Truths, knowing dukkha, the rising of dukkha, the cessation and the path. Then we get the standard definition of dukkha, birth, old age, disease and death, association with what is disliked, separation from what is loved, some variations, sometimes discourses also mention there it is, being unable to get what one wishes, I'm sorry. And in short, the five aggregates affected by clinging are dukkha. Yeah, now there comes something strange here. What is knowledge of the arising of dukkha as it really is? It is this, dependent on old age and death, dukkha comes to be. While I think that old age and death do cause the arising of dukkha for most of us, this is an unusual presentation, and in all other versions it's always craving. So there, I think we have a case of problem in oral transmission. I think the Madhyama Agama recitation at some point, there something has gone wrong in the transmission. Old age and death are usually the final result of the whole change, not what causes dukkha. What is knowledge of the cessation of dukkha? Then, yeah, the cessation of old age and death, and I think it should be the cessation of craving. And we get the Noble Eightfold Path as the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha. Yeah, and then this transmission error brings me to one point I have been asked to comment on, that dukkha is the cause of the arising of craving. The suggestion has been made. And because we are afflicted by dukkha, then we crave. But this is not the presentation we find in the suttas. In the suttas, it's the other way around. Craving is the condition for dukkha. So while it is so that sometimes dukkha may lead to craving, sometimes it may lead in a quite different direction. And there is the Upanishad Sutta that Venerable Kongmu has already been mentioning on the web, on the blog. So it begins very normally with the links of dependent arising, ignorance, formation, consciousness, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming. And from dukkha it leads off in a completely different direction. See, there comes faith, joy, delight, tranquility, happiness, concentration, knowledge and vision, disenchantment, disimpassion, liberation, knowledge of the destruction of the influxes. So clearly here dukkha is not the condition for craving. Much rather it is the condition for the rising of faith that then leads on to practicing the path. Very beautiful discourse. Yeah, we are back to our Madhyama Agama. The next is then knowing old age and death as they really are, the arising, the cessation, and the path to their cessation. I think because this is the next topic, earlier the old age and death came into the previous one by some error in oral transmission. These things happen relatively easy, that something that is close by gets a little bit mixed up. So old age, what is knowledge of old age as it really is? And here we get a description. Hoary hair, lost teeth, deteriorating health, hunched body, unsteady step, shortness of breath, relying on a walking cane, shrinking flesh, sagging skin, wrinkles like pockmarks, failing sense faculties, unsightly complexion. Yeah, the suttas are very detailed with these things, no? Yeah, knowledge of death is then all living beings in their various forms are subject to the ending of life, the impermanence, death, dissolution, extinction, breaking up of their life, the stopping of their vital force. And then comes birth. and knowledge of birth as it really is, as then all beings are born. Then comes becoming, bhava. And here we get the definition of what kinds of becomings there are. And so there's becoming in the sensual realm, which is the realm that we are in right now. And in the form realm, this is the experience that the realms, the Brahma worlds, that according to Buddhist cosmology correspond to the experience of the absorptions. And becoming in the formless realms, these are what corresponds to the so-called immaterial attainments, boundless space, boundless consciousness, etc. Yeah. Now here comes something that I would like to comment on. He knows clinging as it really is, the rising of clinging, the cessation of clinging, the path to the cessation of clinging. What is clinging? Knowledge of clinging as it really is. There are four kinds of clinging. Clinging to sensual desires, clinging to precepts, clinging to views, clinging to a self. This is the difference with the Pali version. The Pali version, I suppose, I hope you have read it, it works similarly through all these links of dependent arising, and each link we get this fourfold diagnostic scheme of the four truths. And then we always get some more explanations of what this term actually means. And in the Pali version, instead the word is clinging to a doctrine of self, or to atavad upadana, a vada, a philosophy, a doctrine. And there is a little problem with this terminology, because the doctrine of a self, the affirming that there is a self, is something that is already gone with a stream enterer. And a stream enterer would also no longer cling to, well, let me go here through the four from top to bottom. So clinging to sensual desires we leave aside for the moment. Clinging to precepts, the Pali version actually gives that a little bit more precise, dogmatic adherence to rules and observances. The idea is that one sticks to certain forms of perhaps ritualized behavior that one believes is absolutely essential and bring about awakening on its own. This does not mean that one thinks that one can get awakened without morality. It's just that this sticking on to doing it in a particular certain way, like I have to do like this in the morning and get up and bow down in this direction and then incense and this, and unless I do that, I won't get awakened. Something of that type. This is also gone with stream entry. A stream enterer, he or she has experienced nirvana, has experienced stream enter, and knows for sure what led there, namely the practice of meditation and letting go. And clinging to views. Views here has a negative connotation. Clinging to views in the sense of philosophical concepts that somehow involve a self or affirming eternity are also gone. So 1, 2, 3, if we speak 2, 3, 4, let me put it like this. 2, 3, 4, if the last one we use, the Pali version, atavarupadana, are gone with stream entry. Sensual desires are gone with non-return. This would mean a non-return has already eradicated all types of clinging. This is not the case. In fact, several discourses explicitly speak of the remainder of clinging that is left in a non-returner. And this clinging is precisely clinging to a sense of I, to a sense of self. Even though the stream enterer he or she has understood that there is no permanent self, there is still that tendency to identify with things, to feel the aura of the appropriating things, this asmi mana, this conceit, I am this, or this is mine. There's a very beautiful simile in the Kemaka Sutta. Here's the reference. Excuse me. There's a discussion between the monks, and then one of them gives the example. He says, somebody who has attained non-return, the third stage of awakening, he or she clearly knows there's no self, no question, but that that tendency to latch on to a sense of self is still there. And it's similar to a dirty cloth that has been cleaned. And now it has been rinsed in the water, so it's clean, but there's still the smell of the salt and the cow dung used for washing around it. And so it needs to be put into some basket with perfumes or fragrances to get rid of that smell. So the process of purification from this notion of selfhood is only comes to its completion when this dirty piece of cloth has put in the perfumed casket and the last remnant of smell is also gone. So the situation with the Chinese version makes this much easier for us because it's speaking of clinging to a self, and we should put in bracket obviously to a notion of self, as there is no permanent self in existence. Obviously it doesn't mean to cling to something that is not there, but to the notion of it. Clinging to ideas of a self is then something that gets only eradicated with arahantship. And so we would, if I go again through these four here, clinging to sensual desires would be gone with non-return, clinging to precepts dogmatically with stream entry, clinging to views with stream entry, and clinging to a self then only with arahantship. That is one of these interesting small differences which kind of help to, there I have it, attavarupadana is the Pali word. Yeah, and here I have a quote from Nyanatiloka. He has already pointed out, he obviously at his time, he didn't know about the Chinese Agama versions, but he already pointed out that traditional fourfold division of clinging is not quite satisfactory, since this would imply that the anagami is entirely free from the four kinds of upadana, the four kinds of clinging. If there are no questions to this, I move on to the next. So here we come to craving, the rising of craving, the cessation of craving, and craving is defined as threefold. In the Pali version it's sixfold according to the senses, if I believe. Here it's in regard to the sensual realm, the form and the formless realm, which I explained already earlier. Then one knows feeling as it really are, and the three types of feeling. Contact. Pleasant contact, unpleasant contact, and neither pleasant nor pleasant, unpleasant nor pleasant contact, neutral contact. Yeah, in the Pali version here I have it, all these three, craving, feeling, and contact, are presented by being defined by way of the six senses. That is the six types of contact, then contact through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, and feeling is the same. This is not a major difference, it's just complementary perspectives. Then the six sense spheres, and they are listed. This is the standard description of the sense spheres or sense bases in early Buddhism, which reckons the mind as a sense alongside the five physical senses. And then comes name and form, and here becomes interesting again. What is knowledge of name? It is this. Name consists of the four non-corporeal aggregates. What is knowledge of form? It is form consists of the four great elements, and what is derived from the four great elements. Yeah, here the definition of name differs from the Pali version, and I am under the impression that we have here an error in the Madhyama Agama, an intrusion of a later concept. You see, we are here in the context of dependent arising. And in dependent arising, nama, rupa, name and form do not stand for the totality of a particular being. Nama does not cover the entire of the mind, because name and form are conditioned by consciousness. Name does not include consciousness in its early Buddhist definition in the context of dependent arising. This idea only comes up in later times. In the Visuddhimagga we have it in the context of one of the insight knowledges, Nama Rupa Pariccheda Jnana, the knowledge of delimitating mind and metta. And there it makes sense to let name, nama, stand for the whole of the mind. But in dependent arising, name only refers to the active parts of the mind, those that are responsible for the coming into being of a name. And these do not include consciousness, because precisely name and form is reflected on consciousness. The two are interrelated. They stand in a reciprocal relationship. There's a very beautiful example provided by Vikunyanananda. He takes the definition of name from the Pali version, and then he describes, he says, it's like a small child unable to understand language, and it gets a rubber ball, a small ball, for the first time. So it smells it, and it feels it, and maybe tries to bite it just to see, and then rolls it a little bit around. And finally it understands, oh, it's something to play with. It's a toy. And here I continue with his explanation, that is from his Nibbana talk. From Brahmanyanananda's Nibbana talk, he says, the child has recognized the rubber ball by those factors included under name in nama rupa, namely feeling, perception, intention, contact, and attention. This shows that the definition of nama takes us back to the most fundamental notion of name, to something like its prototype. So the original sense of nama or name is feeling, perception, intention, contact, and attention. What we do with things that we experience, what we do with them mentally, our way of processing them. And all this processing is experienced by consciousness. And the Madhyama Agama version, for some reason, has lost this sense and instead identifies it with all four aggregates, that is feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness, and thereby includes consciousness. And this is wrong. This must be a later intrusion of a later idea into the discourse. Here I have again the definition of nama from the Pali version. Yeah, it's getting a little much for you today. I know it's a lot of doctrinal stuff, but these points are important to clarify at some point. This connection between consciousness and name and form is a very fascinating area for meditation practice. To see that, because according to the Mahanidana Sutta, they work in reciprocal relationship. See how things, what we experience, the physical objects outside being processed by the mind, reflected on consciousness, and between this processing of things and experiencing of it, this kind of weaving for and back creates what we call the world of our experience. Yeah, then comes consciousness, formations. Yeah, I think I leave it at that. I wonder if I'm still able to get a little bit. Isn't that nama rupa conceptualization? Nama would be conceptualization, yeah. It's that which brings about the genesis of a concept, those mental activities that contribute to it. Rosa, you got it right. And this beautiful image of that Venomanyanana gives, of that little child which does get something that it doesn't know what it is, and then it starts to use all these qualities here where I have them. All these, it feels it, it somehow perceives it. It what can I do with it? It gets a contact, it attends to it, and all these together then are later on, I book it in my mind as rubber ball, a plaything, and then whenever I see it again, then that concept comes and all these things come with it. A form that has a name is a concept. A form that has a name is a concept. We are not saying that form does not exist. the rubber ball is there even if nobody knows a concept to call it. The rubber ball was there for the little child already before it started to do anything with it. We are trying to find that middle way. Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I just thought to clarify that middle way between the realism and idealism. Early Buddhism cuts that middle path where things do exist independent of our cognizing of them, because some later traditions say this is not so. Everything is just produced by the mind. That is not the early Buddhist position. Things do exist, but they do not exist as self-independent unit. They only exist as conditioned processes. And the only way for me to know about them is through my mind, through concepts, or the few experiences without concepts that we are able of. Yeah, I have that diagnostic scheme of the Four Noble Truths, but I like to just briefly go into in the next discourse, just so that I have the feeling we are moving on a little bit, and then I come to your homework. So Madhyama Agama 30, it's another discourse by Venerable Sariputta, again on the Four Noble Truths. He says, whatever countless wholesome states there are, all can be subsumed under the Four Noble Truths. They are all included in the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are declared to be the foremost of all teachings. Why? Because they encompass all wholesome states. Lance Cousins, in a very nice paper on Kusala, he says that we should interpret this here to refer in particular to meditation states, the wholesome states. He says, when Sariputta tells us that all skillful dhammas are included in the Four Noble Truths, we should interpret skillful dhammas here as referring to meditational states. He's a meditator and scholar. So. And then there's Venerable Nyanaponika, a whole little wheel on this discourse, the elephant footprints, and he says, the Four Noble Truths comprise all that is beneficial, all that is truly worth knowing and following after. Again, these two spotlights on the centrality. And then here, Venerable Sariputta with the simile. Venerable friends, it is just as the elephant's footprint is foremost among the footprints of all animals, because it is the greatest, the largest. So too, Venerable friends, the countless wholesome states are all subsumed under the Four Noble Truths. They are all included in the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are declared to be the foremost of all teaching. What are the four? The noble truth of dukkha, the arising of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the noble truth of the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. Yeah, I think I stop at this point and we pick it up in 2 weeks' time, because I still have to give you your homework.
No, he's giving us homework. Oh.
Yeah, because I am not going to able to tell you all my silly ideas and similes next week, I want to still keep pestering you by giving you homework, working with the Four Noble Truths, I think. I hope maybe some of the things I have been presenting have been a little bit abstract today, but this basic fourfold diagnostic pattern, I hope that has become clear. So I would like to invite all of you to try to apply this kind of fourfold scheme to your own personal life in a very practical manner. And then during the 2 weeks' time until next lecture, there will be more time on the blog also to exchange for those of you who are willing and have the courage to share your understanding or failures. So, the first truth for you to see is, can you identify some problem? I think I just put them in here step by one. Identify a problem that you have in your life, whatever it is. Then the second step would be the question, what do I contribute to it? the causes of the problem, not in the general sense, it's because of society, because of the government, because of la-la-la. Learn what is the contribution that I'm making to the situation that this is the problem, that this becomes a problem. This is the second truth for you. Then the third truth is, now having looked at the problem and seen what I contribute to it, the third perspective would be, is there an alternative? Just allowing some space around that problem to see, is there an alternative to that situation, to that particular problem? And then the fourth, you might be guessing it already, what steps do I need to take for this alternative to work? So again, first truth for you, homework, identify some problem in your life. Second question, honestly, sincerely, just between you and you, no need to tell anybody, what do I contribute to it? What is the part that I play for this to keep on being a problem? And then the third one, stepping out of the situation a little bit, is there an alternative? Does it have to be like this? Does this problem have to continue and continue and continue? Is there no way out, or is there an alternative? And then once we have seen the alternative, then what steps could I take so that this alternative comes into being? So you got your homework. And I'm too busy, I can't do it, I'm sorry. So I need you to do and tell me how it works, because I'm sorry, I'm such a busy scholar, you see, I have no time to do it. Okay, I'm sorry for being such a naughty person. And thank you very much for your attention, and I hope you had this lecture, there was at least something in some way useful, and that you will not forget completely about this, and maybe in 2 weeks I will have a few participants listening to me again. Have a nice time until then.